The legions of service people returning from war with post-traumatic stress disorder forced us to take the malady seriously in recent years. PTSD is a very real thing and very damaging to the people who experience it. We've had several discussions about PTSD here on the program, but maybe none from somebody who knows what it feels like firsthand. David J. Morris gives us that perspective in his book, The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. David is a former Marine infantry officer and a reporter. He reported from Iraq at the peak of the American surge there, and he's been published in The New Yorker, in Slate, and in several other publications. He's also a frequent guest on public radio, and we're glad to have him here today. David, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you do know PTSD firsthand. That's one of the big questions here.
Yeah. I first started covering the Iraq War in 2004 and came back and immediately felt different. And, you know, apart from the rest of the country when I returned. And then later in 2009, in 2007, I was in an IED ambush, an IED that hit my the vehicle I was running in. And then in 2009, I was in a movie theater watching an action movie, and there was a very realistically depicted IED ambush in this movie. And I sort of ran out of the theater because it was my brain really couldn't handle what felt like, you know, at the time felt like I was seeing my vision of my own death. And so it was more than my brain could handle. My brain kind of shut down like an overloaded electrical grid. And so I've seen from the inside and had some nightmares about, you know, subsequent to the movie event. So I've kind of been inside it for a time, inside PTSD.
You write about the movie event in the book, and if I recall correctly, what you wrote about was what you were in the lobby pacing around and didn't quite realize how you'd gotten there.
Yeah, and I slipped back in the theater after that and asked my girlfriend what happened, and she said there was an explosion in the movie, and then I ran out. I think it's somewhat atypical. I haven't read a whole lot of other veterans that find that movies are necessarily a huge trigger. But for me, just the realistic noises and explosions can be really upsetting to me, especially like for war movies. And, you know, if you spent any time in Iraq or in Afghanistan or in any wartime situation, you were around a lot of high explosives and you know, you were always the single biggest killer of American troops in Iraq and Afghanistan were improvised explosive devices or roadside bombs. So for me, I have sort of an exaggerated startle response sometimes, or, you know, loud noises, you know, really get my heart going.
How long did it take? First of all, did you know you had PTSD when you first came back from here? And for that matter, what is the terminology? Have PTSD, suffer from PTSD? What's the preference here?
Well, there are some people that are calling for a change to the name, and some people want to call it post-traumatic stress injury, which would make it seem more like a temporary condition. I'm more comfortable with saying, you know, I think the name needs to be kept, PTSD as a term. The history of psychiatry is the history of name changes, and I don't know, think we need another name change. But I prefer to discuss it with others as in terms of having struggling with post-traumatic stress. I don't like being called a PTSD-er or, you know, someone who has PTSD. It sounds, you know, I think struggling with post-traumatic stress is more accurate.
Fair enough. So you obviously were aware that you were in a trauma when you were riding in a vehicle that encountered an IED. So being aware of the trauma is one thing. Being aware of PTSD is another. I mean, how long apart were they? I mean, did you kind of assume you'd have it, or did you find out from the movie, for example?
Well, I sort of assumed when I first returned from Iraq in 2004, I had a general awareness of what PTSD was, and I just sort of assumed that I had it for some reason. And I think that's, in a way, kind of common, because Americans sort of assume that all veterans have it, and there is that concern. But it wasn't until, you know, the movie happened, and I ran into the theater, and then I began to have some nightmares, and just, you know, sort of connected things up with some other events and other patterns in my life that I kind of realized that while I didn't, you know, feel like I needed to be committed, you know, into a full-time care facility, there clearly were some issues. And in the book, I describe it as you know, not, you know, this was the movie event for me was the first time I understood that I didn't have control over my memories, and that I did have some there was some uncontrolled some some anxiety and some memories that I didn't have complete mastery over. And so that was kind of a wake-up call for me.
One of the first things that you offer up in The Evil Hours is the observation that trauma destroys the fabric of time. What do you mean by that?
Well, most people, you know, as any therapist or psychologist will tell you, a healthy person lives from, you know, going from the past into the present, into the future. And they, you know, but they live mostly in the now, in the now that we live in, the present. And with someone suffering from really bad PTSD, you know, or traumas of many kinds, it actually ruins your ability to enjoy and live fully in the present because you are continually reminded of past traumas, and your brain is invaded by memories and associations and triggers that don't allow you to even live in the present. And so that's why, you know, I have been meeting veterans across the country on book tour and meeting people that you could tell their body, it's like their bodies were still in Afghanistan. And so it does, you know, in its worst cases, it makes it very, very difficult to live in the present.
You make the situation easily understandable to people like myself who know and love the movie Slaughterhouse-Five, the way that Billy Pilgrim jumps around in time. That's similar, you report, to what happens to people with PTSD.
Yeah, and Slaughterhouse-Five, the novel and the movie are both really good examples of this idea of fractured time. And in the novel Billy Pilgrim, the first line of the novel is Billy Pilgrim has come unstuck in time. And Billy Pilgrim's a World War II veteran, and he's present for the Allied bombing of Dresden, the German city. And the trauma is so bad that it actually destroys his ability. You know, he becomes unstuck in time and time travels over the course of the novel from, you know, when he first got married, when he was a kid, back to the war, and then even into the future where he sees this group of, you know, he lives among this group of aliens, so... The novel's a really great example of how trauma, you know, destroys time.
David J. Morris from 2015 talking about his book, The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. He's got so much more to talk about. You'll hear the rest of the interview back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, I'm Jeffrey Riley. David J. Morris is both a journalist and a former Marine infantry officer. He has reported extensively on war. He survived the explosion of an improvised explosive device in Iraq, but came home with PTSD. And that's what he writes about in The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. David joined us in February of 2015, and we go back to that interview now. David, there's a real blizzard of facts and figures here at the beginning of the book. In a nutshell, though, how prevalent is PTSD?
Well, close to 10% of Americans will suffer from it at some point in their lives. About some estimates range upwards of 25%, or about a quarter of all returning Iraq and Afghanistan veterans will suffer from it. But importantly, I think, you know, if you could by magic line up every PTSD sufferer in the world, you might think you'd see a lot of military people there, but you'd actually see a lot of rape victims. And rape is the most common and toxic form of trauma. And about half of all rape victims will suffer from PTSD. And just, you know, another statistic out there to keep in mind is, you know, about one in five or close to 20% of all American women will suffer a sexual assault or an attempted rape at some point in their life. So you're talking about, by some estimates, one in 10 people in the United States.
And you just described rape as a toxic form of trauma, more toxic than any other kind?
Yes. The rates of PTSD diagnosis rates for rape victims are about three or four times higher than those who experience combat. And there's a very good set of reasons for that. Combat experiences vary widely, and whereas for rape, it's one of the most, you know, elemental violation of a person's psyche. And some of the first researchers who were first looking at what was first called rape survivor syndrome before PTSD, this is in the 1970s, they actually described it as a kind of psychic death. And they were surprised, you know, and researchers, you know, there had not been a lot of research done on the aftermath of rape up until the 1970s. And researchers in Boston who first started interviewing rape survivors were surprised because almost every single one of the rape survivors they had talked to described the experience of being certain that they were going to die, which was, you know, which is a sentiment common. You see it in Alice Siebold's memoir of her surviving being raped, her book Lucky. You see that, but most rape survivors do think they are going to die. They just assume that that is, you know, part of the process.
Which is a big question raised by your book, which you, just in general for PTSD, people struggling with PTSD, the sense that, I mean, how do you begin to live again when you really thought you were going to die?
Yeah, and it's sort of, and that's one of the reasons that the book, you know, and the idea of PTSD, I think it's one of the mistakes that we make nowadays is we treat it, we largely look to psychiatrists and psychologists and medical professionals to treat these issues, you know, which is useful on the one hand because they are able to offer us some you know, the benefits of some of the scientific research into these conditions. But, you know, for a rape survivor or a combat veteran, you're talking about basically an existential process, you know, returning from a war. Reassembling your life after a natural disaster is more than a medical problem. It's an existential enterprise to rediscover who you are and reassemble your personality and in some ways have your social setting and your community reflect the changes that have happened. That's not really a medical question. That's a social question and an existential question to me.
David Morris, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, his book about PTSD, The Evil Hours. I want to clarify some things about your own experiences because you did serve time in the Marine as an infantry officer, but it sounds like that was in the so-called holiday from history between wars.
Exactly. Yeah, I was on active duty from 94 to 98, probably some of the most peaceful 4 years in the last 50 years. And then when the towers fell on 9/11, and I was already working as a writer, and had a lot of my Marine buddies were in Iraq by the time we invaded. And so for me, you know, I was very interested, having trained in war, and my dad was a Vietnam vet, and I grew up around a lot of Vietnam veterans. For me, it was really important to be in Iraq and to witness the war and to write about it. So I found myself, you know, irresistibly drawn towards it and took three very long reporting trips, all of about 3 to 4 months in length, to Iraq starting in 2004.
Did you ever consider reenlisting, or was this strictly as a reporter you wanted to go back?
No, I was deeply opposed to the Iraq War and was not interested. I was opposed to the Iraq War before it even began, and I was not interested in serving in it because I thought it was an unjust war. If it had been a situation more like Afghanistan, the first part of Afghanistan, where to me it felt like a just war, and my service was something that I had faith in. I would have been inclined to do that, but I'd been out for, 4 years at that point, and I felt like I had served my country, as a Marine, and was very proud of my service, and I learned a lot, and I felt like I could serve my country as a war correspondent as well. And I think that's an important point to make, is that, reporters are serving their country too. I mean, democracy relies on the Fourth Estate. It relies on journalists to report the truth about what's going on. I mean, Thomas Jefferson said if he had to choose between the judiciary or journalism or free press, he would take the free press. And so reporters that go to Iraq and go to Afghanistan are serving their country as well, and I don't think it's inappropriate to thank them for their service.
You were writing in the book about returning from the Marines, though, and again, at a fairly quiet period in American history. But even then, the sense that you were in a zone that didn't really understand what you'd been through. That's typical then, even when you're not particularly in a hot war zone, just coming back from the military and trying to reintegrate into civilian life, there's that sense of alienation.
Yeah, and it's sort of interesting because, Americans, we we love war movies, and we love adventure, and we like explosions and guns. And so there is an enduring interest in, you know, the infantry and warfare and the toys of war. And there's a fascination in America with violence. But there's not often a very fine-grained understanding of the costs of war, or even the mechanical aspects of how warfare works. And so I've always, even when I grew up in San Diego, which is a very, very much a military town, the culture as a whole, in part because it's the West Coast and California, and people are here in large measure because they want to start over and they want to forget. There's not always a very strong interest or concern with, how military life actually works. What wars actually mean, what American foreign policy, how militarized it's become, and what these wars are actually doing to people. And so, there is, and only 1% of America serves in uniform, and I think, we have an all-volunteer force, which I think has become, initially was a very useful idea, and I think everyone agrees that not having to deal with a draft is in a way a good thing. But it has allowed people to be disconnected and to just say thank you for your service, which a lot of veterans sort of are kind of offended by, because people will say that sort of reflexively. But what a lot of veterans hear when they hear thank you for your service is, I feel bad, and I haven't thought about your service at all or the wars at all, but I want to say something to you about it. And so they don't, a lot of people just don't, a lot of veterans just don't even like it, being told, thank you for your service.
David Morris, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. So what then should, particularly in the case of people returning with or without PTSD from military tours, what can people in civilian life do to ease their transition back?
Well, I think one thing it's important to do, if you think about PTSD, it's partly a failed conversation. And I think veterans need to get better about telling their stories and educating the public and learning how to have a better, more honest, less angry discussion with civilians, with people stateside. And I think also people back in the United States need to take a greater interest in the nuts and bolts of military service and what it actually means. Because I don't think most Americans are content to worship veterans and to thank them for their service and go see American Sniper, which is a terrible, awful embarrassment of a movie.
Really? You dislike it that much?
Yeah, and I have to be careful because I have not seen it, but I was in Ramadi with, at the same time Chris Kyle was. And I think, the veterans I've talked to and I've read the book, there's a lot of, it focuses on a lot of the death and the killing. And I think there's this sort of almost pornographic, interest in the gunplay and violence and explosions of the movie. But the movie is horribly inaccurate and just shows, I think people are interested in it because he was, people view of him as some sort of really successful headhunter. And the movie is framed, I think, ridiculously, embarrassingly, to me, as a, the Clint Eastwood framed it as a Western. Iraq is not, it was not, they are not the Indians, and we were not the cowboys. So the idea of thinking of it in those terms is extraordinarily disrespectful to the Iraqi people, and really an immature, childish response to a very complex war that, and it just shows, to me, the movie just shows that Americans really are not serious. They don't want to have a serious conversation about the war, which to me is just a giant disappointment.
So how to broach the subject then? Because one of the things you do say in the book is that for somebody who is struggling with PTSD, talking about the war is not just pointless, but actually damaging.
Yeah, well, I think you need to one way to approach the conversation with a veteran is to ask, start with the particulars of when they served, where they served, and the particulars of their job, what their military occupational specialty was, and get a sense of what they actually did, rather than just asking them if they killed anybody, or asking or thanking them for their service. I mean, it's so rare. I can't think of but a handful of times when someone actually asked me what it was like to be, you know, a rifle platoon commander in a Marine infantry company.
It sounds like it's so close to death that we don't like talking about it as much as we don't like talking about death.
Yeah, and that just shows, you know, that's the wrong thing, because you're not, you know, that's the wrong way to think about it. People think, oh, it's this war, it's this thing that I can't ever talk about. But, you know, most of the time when you were in Iraq, you were really bored and you were hot, sweaty and tired and, you know, hungry and thirsty. And so if you can, you know, if you've been camping, you know half of what it's like to go to war, because there's a lot of the normal discomforts that people experience when you're backpacking. You know, the infantry service in some ways is like backpacking with guns. It's, you know, it's not, you know, it's obviously more serious than that. But, you know, and so I think if people actually ask, you know, what's it like to go on patrol in Helmand Province? What's it like to go on patrol in Garmser? You know, and sort of ask about just the daily life of it. You don't have to ask, what was it like that time your buddy got his arm blown off? Was that really wild, seeing blood squirting out of his arm? You know, those people think that's kind of what they want to ask, which, you know, and those kind of questions really are beside the point. But if you can actually ask someone in a normal way, like, what's it like when someone comes back from a trip to Peru, you ask them, you know, where they went and what they did and what it felt like and who they met. And war is an experience like any other. It's a story, you know, there were people, you know, it's a story about people. It's a story about travel. It's a story about, you know, history. And so I think Americans are, you know, really sort of chickening out and not, you know, just being sort of honest and upfront about it. I mean, some of the best conversations I've had with people about war were non-Americans, people from Germany that understood, like, that sort of grew up with the memory of the Second World War and actually wanted to know what the military was like, you know, from a philosophical perspective and how we looked at foreign policy. And I think, you know, Americans, for whatever reason, it's kind of a big disappointment for me, and I've tried to sort of understand my anger towards this, but a lot of Americans just don't, they just don't want to talk about, you know, so I can't think of but one or two or three conversations I've ever had with civilians about that were meaningful in any way about military service, because, you know, people seem scared of they don't even want to ask about it because it's this taboo topic.
Kind of hushed tones kind of thing. You know, you don't want to, you approach it so carefully, you don't even ask anything meaningful.
Yeah, and when that happens, then, you know, that sort of makes the trauma worse, because then, you know, for a young man returning from Iraq who's been through this really, you know, completely altered state of consciousness known as the war, that they come back and there's no one they can talk to except their buddies, and they feel isolated and weird and alone, and so it makes it worse. And that's, you know, so you know, war can be bad enough as it is, but then coming back and then nobody cares and nobody has any frame of reference or you know, thinks that there's, that, you know, we should have just, you know, people, Americans are very commonly say, well, we should just nuke the place. You know, they just blow the place up. You know, that's what we should do. That's the solution to Iraq. And for, you know, for a veteran coming back who, you know, I knew a lot of Marine veterans that taught themselves Arabic in Iraq and learned a lot about Arab culture. And so to hear these really racist comments about the Middle East is very, very off-putting, very offensive to veterans.
Your approach was the approach of a researcher. When you realized you were struggling with PTSD, you went to the library at UC San Diego. And what kind of literature did you find?
Well, it's interesting because the literature of PTSD is very chaotic, and there are a couple of books that sort of talk about that I found interesting that deal with trauma in the ancient world. Jonathan Shea's series of books about the Iliad and the Odyssey and how those relate to modern day trauma in Vietnam I found very interesting. But generally speaking, there's just a lot of disconnected science that looks into the endocrinology and the neuroscience and you know, the therapies that deal with PTSD. But I didn't. I mean, one of the reasons I ended up writing this book was I wanted a book that would actually engage the literature and explain where PTSD came from historically, and where, you know, what science has told us about it since PTSD was first recognized. And when I started looking into things, I was surprised because PTSD is a really new psychiatric disorder in the sense that it was only recognized in 1980. You know, it's about as old as cable television. But there are elements of it that have been around forever. I mean, there are New Guinean tribes. Anthropologists have gone back and interviewed tribesmen from New Guinea, which are these very well-preserved pre-scientific human societies, and found that tribal warriors from New Guinea, for instance, suffer post-battle nightmares. So there are aspects of PTSD that appear to be immortal, appear to be central to the human condition. But I didn't, you know, the research literature, and I couldn't find a book that sort of told me what I wanted to know about what PTSD is and where it came from. And what I learned, I mean, we PTSD was first recognized in 1980, and what I learned researching this book was that the reason we have PTSD, the reason we have this disorder that all survivors can speak to, is because of the Vietnam War and the aftermath of the Vietnam War, when all these Vietnam vets kind of banded together to advocate for some sort of recognition for their suffering.
Many more questions for David Morris, the author of The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. He visited in February 2015. You'll hear the rest of the interview here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Reporter and Marine veteran David Morris returned from a trip to Iraq, a survivor of an improvised explosive device, but with PTSD. He learned much more about his condition and the many people who share it, and wrote the book The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. The interview is from 3 years ago, so we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. It is a very comprehensive book, as you point out, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. I know you were inspired by Siddhartha Mukherjee, who joined us within the last year to talk about the emperor of all maladies, his biography of cancer. But some of the stuff you get into here, just on societal level, things like Susan Faludi's quote about the whole country showing signs of PTSD. What did she mean?
Well, there are aspects of the culture which, I think it's foolish to diagnose an entire country with PTSD, but there are aspects of American culture as we experience it today that seem reminiscent of the disorder. Specifically, you know, our obsession with 9/11, the way we continue to revisit it in film and TV, sort of speaks of a kind of a repetition compulsion. And then, you know, as well, we have this really deep concern with national security. And, you know, which is, you know, and surveillance and military operations that in some ways are reminiscent of a, you know, kind of a national hypervigilance, you know, hypervigilance being one of the major symptoms of PTSD. I mean, and just as an example, you know, more people were killed last year by bee stings than by terrorists.
Bee stings, you know? Really?
Bee stings. And yet we continue to act as if we are under you know, this imminent threat of annihilation, you know, every minute of our lives, when in fact, you know, ISIS, you know, does operate, you know, in Iraq, but they do constitute a threat to us. But do we need to allocate over, you know, by some estimates, almost half of our national budget to national defense and to surveillance? Do we need to surveil every email, every phone call in the United States to look for terrorists? I don't think so. A lot of military analysts don't think so either. So there is kind of this sense that since 9/11, we've become obsessed with terrorism, which is, you know, in some ways an exaggerated threat.
When you write about some of the technical issues that go on in the mind with PTSD, you bring up things like dissociation, the separation from the event, some sense of separation from reality. There's a lot of discussion in the book about the parallel track and your mind working on the old event and then trying to work in today's world as well, which gets back to the discussion earlier about how trauma destroys the fabric of time. But what happens to people who go through the same trauma together, I wonder? What happens to those relationships?
I mean, like a group of soldiers?
Right.
Well, in some ways that if it happens to one group of guys or girls, that it does offer the chance to sort things communally and to have some people who understand what you've been through. And so I think generally speaking, you know, people like war correspondents are actually thought to have a higher PTSD rate in some cases because they actually go to war zones and then return alone. And they tend to go back to newsrooms where they're probably one of a handful of people that have been to a war zone, whereas groups of soldiers come and go and they return together. And so they have, you know, that sense of unity and a sense of a common lexicon, a common language, and a common set of experiences that they can all kind of talk about. So that, so together, you know, undergoing a trauma as a, you know, a close military unit that then comes back to the United States and stays together for a period of time, that's what researchers call a protective factor, which will prevent, in some cases, the onset of PTSD, if that makes sense.
It does. Let's take some calls. We have Jacob in Springfield on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Morris, the author of The Evil Hours.
So I want to point out that in the history of the malady of PTSD since the 80s or the 70s of the Vietnam War, no one has ever been cured of PTSD. And it's partly because how we define the condition. We tell people that they're essentially a walking time bomb and they're fragile as China and one day they're going to explode and they could revert at any time. It's a chronic recurring condition. But I see PTSD as a basic childhood phenomenon. Let's say you were riding a horse and you fell off the horse and you got pretty bruised and your ego was hurt and you've got this malingering fear, okay, and then you refuse to get back on the horse. Because that's your, you've got a fear of it, and that's actually a pretty reasonable fear. But if you fixate on it, obsess on it, and always think about it, and people tell you you're never going to get better from this condition, and that from now on you can't work and you have to be, you know, like a handicapped person with special privileges, and they could spend $10 million on you and you'd never get better, and sometimes they might send you on a trip to you know, climb Mount Everest or, you know.
All right. Well, I want to get to a point here because let me just ask it this way of David. Thanks for the call, Jacob. Do people actually say things like that, like you'll never get better? Is it like alcoholism? You never are cured, but you recover?
Yeah. I mean, the conventional wisdom on the subject is that the idea of speaking of PTSD in terms of a cure is probably the wrong language. And people, the thinkers that I like on the subject tend to talk of it in terms of recovery. And specifically, I like to think of it in terms of personal change. Like after you've been through a war and you are having nightmares and other PTSD symptoms, I think it's foolish to want to expect that you can return to the pre-war state or the pre-trauma state. And instead, you know, you want to manage your symptoms and address the underlying concerns with them, but then think about, okay, that event happened, you know, by any reasonable standard, going to a war is going to make you a different person. What life lessons can I draw from that experience, and what kind of person can I change into who will be a better reflection of what's changed, you know, of that experience? So I think, you know, I tend to think of it in terms of change, you know, and growth, and, you know, not... You know, the idea of thinking of that you can cure it or that you can remove the toxin of trauma from your bloodstream or from your body, I think is the wrong way to think of it.
Brad in Ashland, you're on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Morris.
Thank you. I believe this is the same gentleman that wrote a recent article in the New Yorker on the topic. And if it is, I was very impressed with that. And I'm impressed with the things he's saying about thanking the journalist and coming back with a rational and humane understanding of war instead of a rah-rah, let's just jump into a new one like Netanyahu wants us to do. I'm also cognizant that we're past the 60s now, man, and peace and love, remember all that stuff? Well, those people were messing with certain substances, which they're now using in studies to treat PTSD, namely cannabis, marijuana, pot, as the most common thing that people use, I suppose, but also shrooms. There's a recent interesting article in the New Yorker about using mushrooms. Mm-hmm. And then MDMA. I saw an article just yesterday out of MAPS that in Canada they're starting MDMA, which is ecstasy.
Really?
which gives people a 4-hour relief from paranoia and anger and so forth, so they can feel something different, which I think is necessary for sufferers of PTSD to have some respite from their fear and anger and all that. So I was wondering if he's aware of these new avenues of research and what he might think about those substances. I know they don't apply to everybody, but they might help a lot of people. Thank
all right,
you.
Thanks for the call, Brad.
No, I think MDMA and cannabis hold great promise as therapeutic modalities for PTSD. Specifically, I mean, MDMA or ecstasy was originally designed as it came into existence and was originally designed as a therapeutic drug. And I think, interestingly, under supervised conditions and in limited dosages, I think MDMA can be incredibly useful because it tends to negate the fear circuitry of the brain and allows a person, under the influence of the drug to experience, as the caller just said, a less fearful state and kind of escape from their paranoias and fears. So I think, MDMA, which researchers are just now beginning to look into, because it's an unusual therapy, the government's been very strict. The Canadian government, a Canadian researcher has been trying for a number of years to do research with MDMA, and it took her a very long time. She had to hold the drug had to be held in a vault that the government ran, that the government had control over. So it's been difficult to kind of get the government on board with getting behind and supporting this kind of research.
Interesting, but they're certainly trying to do some work with stuff that heretofore was just seen as recreational sorts of drugs. There's a point in the book about the sense of control over a situation and the reaction to trauma, and I guess in this context it's much easier to understand why there is so often PTSD with rape. But so what is it going on there? Basically, if you have less control, you're more likely to get PTSD?
Yes. And one of the central commonalities among people that develop PTSD is that, in the situation of rape or in particular parts of combat, there is this sense of being absolutely overwhelmed or being rendered helpless. And that's why for rape victims, one of the reasons rape can be so toxic as a form of trauma is the idea of being completely, the organism is completely overwhelmed and completely helpless. And struggle is basically, pointless at that point, at that stage. And so that's where true harm and damage can grow from, that feeling of total helplessness. And interestingly, W.H.R. Rivers, who was this famous British psychologist after World War I, looked at what they called shell shock within, which is sort of a precursor to PTSD. He looked at that within the Royal Air Force and found that between pilots and aerial balloon observers, pilots were far less likely to develop shell shock as opposed to an aerial balloon observer where the balloon was basically static over the battlefield. And the reason was the balloon pilots were immobilized or were essentially helpless and had less control over their environment and were thus more likely to develop psychological harm from their combat trauma.
So the circumstances in which the trauma is produced obviously vary greatly, and to some degree then the way in which the PTSD manifests. But you also talk about changes in the perceptions of PTSD since the birth of photography and cinema. Like what?
Well, interestingly, I mean, people presume that the flashback is, the central condition, the central part of PTSD. When in fact, a group of researchers from King's College in London went back and looked at the memoirs and accounts of war survivors, people who served before the age of cinema, and found that they did not report what we would call flashbacks. And for example, American Civil War veterans were far more likely to report their intrusive symptoms in terms of visitations by ghosts, spirits, and demons.
Interesting. So you came down pretty hard on a particular movie, American Sniper, just a little bit ago. I'm curious to know, in this age of so many people coming back from military service with PTSD, what you make of things like first-person shooter games.
Well, I personally don't like them. They're too violent. They glorify and sort of turn it into a form. They turn combat into a form of entertainment. The research behind them does not indicate that they are in some way traumatizing, but I don't I guess for me, and I don't really go to war movies anymore, and at this point in my life, I, you know, do not find warfare to be really a beneficial form of entertainment, which is why I have not seen American Sniper, is I don't want to see my experience transformed into something I enjoy with popcorn. But yeah, first-person shooter video games, and I think for people that grow, that, you know, what people are starting to call digital natives, you know, people that are younger than me that you know, grow up around all this media, they just sort of, they look at it as a kind of entertainment and sort of think of, you know, I think a lot of Americans generally think of war, you know, as a whole, as a first-person shooter video game, and that's not the, that's not something that I'm entirely comfortable with.
So what does work in treating PTSD? I mean, and we talked to Phil Zimbardo and his partner last year about the time cure, and it seems like getting people to understand the passage of time again, to get past that destruction of the fabric of time, does help a bit.
Yeah, and I, you know, as we just talked about, one of the, I think one of the emerging therapies for PTSD is MDMA, or some sort of hallucinogenic drug therapies. Additionally, the VA does have a group of what they call evidence-supported therapies that I'll outline briefly. One of them is called prolonged exposure, and that asks people to tell the story of their worst trauma over and over again. And the idea is eventually that by telling the story, it will lose some of its traumatic charge and become like any other normal memory. And they find that about 60% of veterans who undergo prolonged exposure therapy do see some improvement in their symptoms, although there are some side effects associated with prolonged exposure.
Here, the book is called The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. David J. Morris wrote it, and he's been our guest. David, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me, man.